Thank you very much for the invite. Like Roger said, we're only 24 kilometers away, but I've never actually visited this institute, so it's a pleasure to be here and meet you all. This talk is going to be divided in two parts. One is just sort of a smorgasbord, a bit of what we do in my lab to sort of intro you to what's going on. And then the second part will be sort of a more focused research talk around this dataset augmentation and feature space. So if I were to just show you a single diagram of what's going on in my lab, and I were to break it down in two words, I'd say we do deep learning. Okay, so deep learning is what we do, but we do focus it really on three areas in deep learning, and they all just happen to start with A. Algorithms and architectures, applications, and acceleration. Okay, so I'm just going to walk you through each of these three A's to start with, and then describe some specific projects, and also what each of these things mean from a machine learning point of view. Okay, so we'll start with algorithms and architectures. So I was told most of you are physicists who have some experience with machine learning, so I'm not going to tell you about what machine learning is all about. You know, it's input, there's some magic that happens, and then it produces some useful outputs, okay? Those could be decisions or visualizations. Essentially, the important part is what goes on inside this box, okay? So, these functions that go from inputs to outputs, I could write something to square numbers, right? So, it's a function, right? It's one of these boxes. There's some magic that happens, it gives you an output. I could write another function to take some music and generate an audio wave, and you would hear it, and it would sound beautiful. These are things that myself as a programmer could do with relative ease, but there's a lot of problems. You know, everybody likes to talk about self-driving cars. It's certainly one of them, where you wouldn't want to actually write a program to do this mapping, right? So the inputs here might be the various sensors on the vehicle. And there's many of them in modern autonomous vehicles. The outputs here actually is fairly simple output space. It's like steer left, steer right, accelerate, brake, and so forth. But what's going on inside the box, that mapping from the input space to the output space, is really complicated. So the best thing to do here is really try to learn from experience rather than sit down and try to actually write a program to do it. Okay, so when I talk about architectures, I talk about how that magic in the middle is constructed. So what's the actual structure of that mapping from input to output? Okay, so in deep learning, we like to say that we take inspiration from the brain and we map it onto architectures like feedforward networks or convolutional networks, which I'll talk about later on. And this is actually one area where Canada has importance in the world scene. So deep learning has roots in Canada, sponsored through CIFAR, sponsored through NSERC, and there's a lot of activity going on in this space. All right, so the general paradigm when we're talking about algorithms, okay, beyond the architecture of the structure, is how do you actually adjust those parameters of that structure? There's some knobs that need to be tuned. And typically, if we're talking about sort of a supervised learning setup, we're going to present examples, goes to the system, and our model makes a prediction. So here, say we're doing classification. I show it a banana. It says it's a trumpet. That's wrong. I show it the ground truth, and I send this error signal back through the network such that the next time, hopefully when it sees a banana, it predicts banana. So that's what I'm distinguishing between the architecture, which is like how this box is structured, and the algorithm, which is essentially the way that you actually do these adjustments and updates. So generally, it's the designer, the practitioner that fixes the architecture and chooses a learning algorithm, and then the actual knobs that are adjusted are done through this process of learning. Now, a lot of people like to think about deep learning or talk about it as the end of feature engineering. So classical machine learning, you would have a data set, you would extract a number of features from it that are sort of created with some domain knowledge, and then you would apply a reasonably simple machine learning model. And people in deep learning like to sort of motivate deep learning as sort of the end of this process of careful feature construction. And certainly I agree with this to some extent. The advent of deep learning has meant a lot of feature learning as opposed to feature construction, but architectures have certainly become more complex. So if you, deep learning people like to work on vision problems, so maybe some of you have heard of convolutional architectures like Inception or ResNet or VGGs and so forth. These are all growing in complexity. They're deeper, they have more parameters, and this has generally been the story after the last few years, is increasing your performance by building more and more complicated architectures. So in a sense, like this blog post from last year argues, essentially people have moved from feature engineering to architecture engineering. One issue with architecture engineering is that we may be reaching a plateau in the ability to just engineer our ways out of problems. So if you look at this, there's a paper by Eugenio Culicerio at Purdue. And he looked at this last year in terms of the complexity of models and their accuracy on a standard benchmark. So this is the ImageNet benchmark. It's a visual recognition data set that machine learning people like to test out their algorithms on. And the right or the x-axis here is operations, so giga operations. It's just a matter of computational, the complexity going on inside the network, essentially how long it would take to actually process an image. And then the other thing that's being shown is the number of parameters in each of these models, and that's shown by the size of the circle. Okay, so you'll see the trend. There's no chronology here, but they're essentially the trend over the last few years has to sort of move upwards in giga operations, but also improve in terms of top one accuracy on ImageNet. Okay, so you can see essentially pushing up, increasing complexity, but the argument here being made by Culicerio is essentially we might be seeing some sort of plateau in terms of just pushing out in terms of deeper and deeper architectures and more complex architectures. So one thing that we've been quite interested in my lab in recent years is essentially figuring out how to automatically generate architectures that are more performant for a specific problem. And we've looked at this in the context of multimodal fusion problems. So for a number of years, we worked on this competition, which was gesture recognition. It's called the Chalearn multimodal data set for human activity or gesture recognition, where you have a number of sources. You have depth video, you have standard RGB video, you have an audio stream, and you also, from the depth video, get a skeleton. Okay, so you have a number of different signals. And we started working on this in about 2014. And Natalia Neverova, who was a grad student working on this, ended up winning the competition by building a deep network that consumed all of these different modalities. And it fused them in a very sensible way. So the first thing she tried, obviously, which is what a lot of people in deep learning would try, is just take all these different modalities and give them as input to a gigantic deep neural net and just, you know, train it with gradient descent and hope it works out. It doesn't work so well. So she had a very careful process by which the modalities were fused by essentially their likeness. So for example, depth video and RGB video are similar in nature. They're visual modalities, so they would be merged first. And then we would merge in pose estimation. It's also somewhat a visual modality. It's 1D instead of 2D, but it would be essentially merged in at another point in time. And then finally, the audio, which is more distant than the other modalities, would eventually be merged in. And what she found is that, you know, each on their own, each of these modalities would get a certain error on the benchmark. So for example, the intensity alone, this is actually only the intensity video around the hands, because that's what she was using, got a pretty high error rate. And depth video was a little bit more informative, and it would get a certain error rate. The mocap alone was actually quite useful, and it would get a certain error rate. And when you merged the intensity and the depth video, you would get quite a drop in error rate. And then when you took the single hand intensity and depth and merged both of the hands, you'd get a further drop. When you merged in the motion capture with the pixel-based data, so the depth and the intensity, you would get a further drop. And then the audio, which was sort of mid-grade on its own, when it was merged in with the visual information, you would get a further drop. And what you're seeing in the final step here is that we had several networks that were operating on different temporal scales, and the final step was to merge all the temporal scales together. So the main point here being that each time you integrated a different type of data or modality, you got a drop in error rate, but this was carefully constructed by Natalia, and what we would like to do is essentially be able to figure out how to do that automatically.
Okay?
The way that you're observing the data. So say your data is coming in at different frames, like frames of video, for example. And you know, video might be, I don't know, 25 frames per second or 30 frames per second or something like that. And so you could have basically one network that is looking at a very fine spatial resolution, so it's basically looking at every frame, and then you have might have another one that's only looking at windows that's sort of sampled every other frame, and another one that's looking at sort of every fourth frame or something like that. So basically, one network was very coarsely sampled, one network was very sort of mid-range sampled, another one was very finely sampled, and those essentially had the exact same architecture, but they were merged in, because if you consider something like gesture. Or activity recognition, which we do, there are things happening at very different temporal scales, right? So the audio might be conveying information at one scale. You might, and even it's really spatio-temporal, because you might have not only sort of dialogue down to sort of nuances in the tone that might be recognized at different temporal scales, but you might even have things happening at different spatial scales. So for some gestures, like very fine-grained finger movements, might convey some information, whereas other gestures, like overall body language, might convey different information. Okay. All right, so we've embarked on a number of different projects, which have the flavor of essentially automatic architecture discovery for these multimodal type problems. So in this one, we employed this technique called Bayesian optimization to essentially search over networks of this form, where we would have a certain number of input modalities. These are in green. So the green things would be like your video and your audio and your depth information. And then we would allow these networks to have a certain number of fully connected layers after a merger. And we varied two things, basically the number of fully connected layers that were allowed to happen after each merger and the order in which these different modalities were merged together. Okay. Obviously, there's a lot larger search space you could look over. You could even look at the type of operation that was used as a merger. We were just using concatenation of features. You could also search over the overall depth of the network, or the sort of the types of modality-specific networks that arrived at that initial representation. But we restricted it just to this search over these two things. And so the main thrust of this work was coming up with a similarity metric for these, which could compare two different network structures. And that was essentially what we needed. It was essentially a kernel that could be plugged into Bayesian optimization, and that would do a very efficient search over the architectures. And what it found is that it could actually discover an architecture that was just as good as the one that Natalia had discovered by hand in a reasonable number of search iterations, so on the order of like 10 or 20 trials. Okay, the downside to this approach of effectively searching over different networks is you have to train each one to convergence on your data set and then measure its performance. And then this Bayesian optimizer will basically try this architecture next, and then you'd have to train that to convergence, measure it. So after about 20 of those trials, you would get to a reasonable solution, but it was still reasonably expensive. We've pursued another approach. Has anybody heard of dropout in deep learning? This is sort of where you're eliminating activations of features. There's something called drop connect, where you can drop out weights while you're training. These are part of a larger family of techniques called stochastic regularization. So you're actually changing either their activities or the weights during training. So each presentation of a different example has a different set of activations or different set of weights that are dropped out. We set up something similar, but for modalities. So actually, the connectivity between different modalities would be changed for each presentation of example. So in this way, we were able to explore a whole bunch of different types of modality connection architectures during a single stage of training a network. Okay, so now we're no longer training a network to convergence for each type of modality configuration. We can explore a whole bunch with this stochastic regularization. So you can imagine here, the idea is that if you have a layer, say this is sort of about the input of the network, you have inputs corresponding to each modality, which is a different color. If you set a weight matrix to be just block diagonal, it means that there's no crosstalk between the modalities. So you just learn a representation, like a modality-specific representation at the next layer. Sorry. In this case, if you allow some off-diagonal structure, then you can have this set of hidden units taking input from multiple modalities and effectively doing a merger. And this is the fully connected setup where you have weights on all off the diagonals. You basically have a fully connected setup where modalities are fully talking to one another. So essentially, you stochastically set these guys during training and then learn an optimal connectivity structure while you're training one network. Okay, so that's some work on architecture, algorithms and architectures.
Dropout has a schedule, or is it just stochastic?
So there's essentially, in dropout, you set a probability, which is like your dropout probability. People typically set it to 0.5. Like half of the time, you drop out a particular unit. What we're doing is we have dropout probabilities that are associated with different modality connections, like connecting one modality to another. And instead of just setting those, like in dropout, we're actually learning those. And then we're sampling from them. So it stochastically explores different connections, but it's learning these probabilities during training. So at the end of the day, it effectively learns which modalities should be connected to which modalities at which layer. Okay, so once you get beyond layer one, it's no longer really a pure modalities. It could be a blend of modalities, but you're still learning which of those blended modalities should be talking to other blended modalities. Okay, that's the flavor. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about applications in the lab. A lot of our applications tend to be human-centric in vision. Okay, so people are the dominant subjects in most images and video you find online. So it's an important problem, and there's a lot of data sets available to tackle human-centric vision problems. However, we're not just doing, I've showed you sort of gesture recognition, we do activity recognition or some emotion and that type of thing. Being at Guelph, does anybody know sort of what Guelph is best known for in terms of its science? What would you associate with Guelph in terms of, say, a department?
OVC.
OVC, right? So either OVC or OAC, so the Veterinary College or the Agricultural College. So there's a lot of ag-focused research going on there. And so we have done some collaborations with people in agriculture. For example, this collaboration looked at doing vision in these smart traps that were deployed in orchards, and they would look for a specific type of insect pest that was destroying the orchard. So we're looking for a particular type of moth in this example. So some of the problems that we look at are we're interested in deploying machine learning in embedded systems like this. We've done work with Google where we've actually worked on machine learning systems in phones. So this is another project a couple years ago where we tried to build a continuous authentication system for phones. So you have a Nexus phone from Google. It has several different sensors on it. And each of those sensors can essentially build a picture of who's using it. So we're trying to get rid of pins and passcodes, right? Because they take a long time, they're not super secure. But if your phone is using its GPS and the way you type and the way you move your body and the camera, if you're open to doing that, it can build an accurate picture of who's using it. And if you take my phone and start typing on it, it would lock up, right? So we worked on the body motion component again because we do a lot of human-centric vision. But there are a lot of problems associated with actually running the machine learning algorithm in a device, dealing with issues like privacy and so forth. Okay, so those are some of the applications we work on. Finally, acceleration. Okay, so I guess most people know what this is. Okay, probably. Do you guys have much GPUs here at Perimeter?
Kendrick has.
Okay.
And then we use Graham.
Graham, yeah. I mean, the new Cedar and Graham clusters are pretty amazing. Like, they're P100s, and there's lots of them. And
but we didn't get time on it lately. Maybe it's because of you guys.
I know one of my grad students was killing it when it first came online, but so it's basically maxed out now?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's not surprising. There's a lot of demand for GPUs. So anyways, we do some research on the acceleration side, particularly with respect to GPUs. We manage a few clusters in Guelph. So we have a couple that are sort of dedicated to our lab, and then we have a CFI contributed cluster that's on SharkNet. Those are K80s though. They're sort of a couple generations back from the P100s. That's on Graham. And I mean, the paradigm for deep learning has typically been sort of working in the cloud, working in server farms, running your computations, and sort of being disconnected from the model via the internet. But certainly, as I mentioned before, we have been doing work, like for example, in the agricultural space with drones. So we're certainly interested in how we can do computation at much sort of in a tighter space and with much less power, right? Because if you have something like this, where it's not just surveying a field, but it's deciding to where to actually apply nitrogen or water or whatever the deficiency is, based on what the machine learning system is telling it, it wouldn't be so useful if it's always going back to dock for battery. Okay, so we're working in terms of how to do multi-GPU computation at low power, and we have a library for Theano, which is a deep learning library that does essentially multi-GPU parallelism. So if you write a model in Theano, you have access to a cluster like Graham that has multiple GPUs, either in a single box or across boxes. This allows you to easily parallelize your computations. Some other frameworks like TensorFlow are providing that kind of service for you. PyTorch, I think, has some sort of limited multi-GPU functionality. I don't think necessarily across nodes yet, but definitely within a box. So these are some of the things that we look at in terms of, like, you know, if you add number of workers, you have one GPU, two GPUs, four GPUs, eight GPUs, how close can you get to linear speed up, right? We do things like minimize the communication bottleneck when you're exchanging messages between the GPUs, and do tricks like using low precision to do communications and so forth. So that's flavor of the work. That's the project. It's on GitHub. And then we've also been experimenting lately with FPGAs, which are a type of low power reconfigurable type of hardware. You can think of FPGAs like programmable hardware, in a sense. They're less flexible than GPUs, and they're harder to program, but things are changing. So just as you might have heard of like the CUDA language for GPU programming, there's an alternative called OpenCL that's been around for a while. It's an open standard, and it can actually program not only GPUs, but multi-core CPUs and FPGAs and so forth. So we've done some work on sort of deep learning on alternative hardware platforms. Okay, so that's the whirlwind tour of some of the stuff that's going on. Now, unless anybody has any questions about this is sort of a natural point for questions, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about this science. Okay, good. So for those of you who are familiar with deep learning research and the applications of deep learning, you may have noticed that there's three domains in particular where it has really excelled. Vision, speech and audio, and text or natural language processing. There's a ton of applications, there's a ton of data sets and benchmark in this space. And this is really where a lot of the gains have been made in recent years. Now, what's common to all three of these data sets? Does anybody know?
Time?
So they're temporal.
Sequence.
They're sequences, okay, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Vision, not always, right? Unless you sort of took of course, video is, but you take a static image and read the pixels as a pixel stream, so you could convert it into a time series. What else? What other properties of the data, like generally, compared to other types of data sets you might model in machine learning?
There's a lot of it.
High dimensional, there's a lot of it, right? So both it's like, it's really high dimensional. There's a lot of it. You can generally pull down a lot of examples for it. And the other thing I would put forth is that it's unstructured. Okay, so it's not like a patient record where you've named each attribute. There's like, if you take something like pixels, you don't put a name on every single pixel. So essentially we'd say this is unstructured data, it's high dimensional, there's a lot of it, and this is why deep learning tends to be a good match for these sorts of problems. So, however, there's been an issue in terms of propagating it to other domains, okay? So one of these issues is actually getting access to these sorts of data sets. And what people do, say you're working on a vision problem, and you have ImageNet, which has a million images for sort of classical visual recognition problems, like detect a boat, detect a house, detect a dog, detect a coffee cup or whatever. But then someone says to you, well, I actually want to build a classifier that detects bird species. So a classical trick is to essentially train your model on ImageNet, the generic data set, okay? Learn some reasonable features for that data set, then essentially replace the top layer that has the categories like boat and dog and cat and all the generic labels, and you replace those with bird species, okay? And then you train this whole model on the smaller data set, okay? So you've, in a sense, you've leveraged a large data set to build some reasonable features, and then you've replaced the top part of the network so you can predict on some other data set, and then you've fine-tuned it. Either you've trained just the top, which some people do, or you've gone all the way back to the network and adjusted the features to be better at the specific problem like bird detection. And I suspect many of you have heard of this trick. People used to use unsupervised learning. We were having a conversation about RBMs back in the day, and that was sort of the advent of deep learning in like 2006 to 2009. People were pre-training things like deep belief nets by stacking RBMs. So it's a similar flavor. But in recent years, supervised pre-training has kind of become the norm. Now, this trick really won't work for you if you have very specific data. Like you have data coming out of like a microscope, or you have data being collected off a satellite or a drone or something like that. Because it doesn't really match that large data set that you would use for pre-training, right? Images like this or this are very different than the images that you would find in ImageNet. Okay, so if you have a very specific problem, things that people have also looked at are things like training on totally synthetic data. And I think you guys are probably familiar with training on synthetic data as well. But again, we work a lot in vision, so I'm going to use some visual examples for you. There's some work out at UBC training models on Grand Theft Auto, the game, and then applying it to real-world video being captured from cars, for example. And because computer games have gotten so realistic in their images or their renderings, it actually tends to work, right? You basically have unlimited label data from the game because these things all start as objects. You know exactly where the cars are and the trees are. So you can apply this to a semantic segmentation problem in the real world. And there's also, you can just sort of do the straight up thing, just do it naively. Or there's some really interesting recent work where people look at this, what they call domain adaptation, which is when there's a difference between your source, like what you train the model, and then like what you test the model on. You can actually use certain strategies to reduce the error when you actually start testing on something that by nature is quite different, right? This is real, this is synthetic. Okay, we've done a little bit of this work too, where we render kind of scary looking people from the software called Poser. We're interested here in figuring out the specific locations of the hand when we observe somebody. And we've had success actually doing this, building synthetic data sets where we know exactly where the different parts of the hand are, and then applying this on video of real people. Okay, so this is an interesting trick, but it only works when there's good overlap between the synthetic domain and the real domain. Another trick you may have heard about is basically ubiquitous in vision, is to do something called data set augmentation. So you take your data and you manipulate it in known ways that you would expect to encounter in your test data set or when you apply the model. So in vision, people might change the color of their images or shift them or scale them or whatever. And This would increase the size of your training data set. It would generally make your models more robust to these sorts of transformations that come at test time. It works really well, like I said, for vision when you really understand that space. It might work for audio. I see people, you know, doing sort of pitch shifting and so forth. But when you move to a domain, even within vision or audio, if it's very specific and you don't really understand the way that images or your data should transform, you can't do it anymore. It's really laborious, right? Because someone has to go and design all these transformations, code them up, and then apply them. So if you're working in a totally different domain, well, what can you do? What can you do sort of that's an automated way of creating more robustness? So this is something that's been done in the past, is essentially you do more general transformations. You take, I'm again showing you an image example, but you could do this with the other types of data. You have some sort of random distortion field that gets applied to the pixels, okay? And then you smooth that out. And then that gives you essentially a new image that has maintained the same class, right? It still has the identity 6, but this 6 clearly looks a bit different than this and this as well. So this has been applied again in specific domains. That's after smoothing. What about something even simpler? Okay, so going back an even sort of a longer amount of time, people have looked for at imbalanced data sets. This is where you have way more examples of one class than the other. And they've tried to increase the amount of examples in the underrepresented class by simply interpolating between the examples. Okay, so you've got these three data points in the red class. You've got way more in the blue class. And I'm just going to make more red data by taking all my red points and interpolating them, okay? So I can sort of take these guys, interpolate, and I can even go maybe extrapolate as well. Seems like a sensible thing to do. Okay, so now I've just created more red data, now I can train up my model, and it'll be, you know, I won't have these class imbalance problems. And so this is a very popular technique. It's called, you can see the full name, but people call it SMOT, okay? And this has been done. However, okay, for low-dimensional data like this, it actually might work reasonably well. But for high-dimensional data, like images, this actually doesn't work very well. So when you linearly interpolate images in pixel space, I don't know if anybody's ever done this before, you take a 3 and you interpolate sort of with a 9. In the middle, you get things that don't really look like image, right? It's images. It's not, or digits. It's not really a smooth morph from a 9 to a 3. And this figure is taken from a paper from the Bengio lab from a few years ago. And I think it's really nice because it sort of explains what's going on here. So in high dimensional spaces, the data tends to lie on a low dimensional manifold, which is really twisty and curvy and nasty and has some complicated geometry. And neural networks tend to, I don't know if you've ever seen some demos of what's going on when a neural network sort of hits some data, it tends to unfold it and increase the volume as it sort of moves up in representational layers. Okay, so there's a nice sketch up here sort of in pixel space down, like at the visible layer or the data layer. You have a high dimensional space, but your 9s and your 3s are on some sort of nasty low dimensional manifold that has complicated geography. And as you start learning hidden layers, say by unsupervised learning with an RBM or an autoencoder or something like that, your data unfolds and occupies more volume. Okay, because these things are trained to represent digits, right? Not all possible images. Okay, so this is kind of what happens when you learn a representation layer. And so each time you learn another layer and you start trying to do interpolation, it's less likely that you're going to interpolate and hit something that lies completely off the manifold. Okay? Is that sort of intuitive argument reasonable to you? Okay? So this is going to be sort of the starting point for this work. So let's try to achieve sort of a domain agnostic type of augmentation.
I mean, why did you do the interpolation here? Like, I mean, I'm confused because in the first slide where you were doing interpolation, okay?
Yes.
So you were doing interpolation basically between, say, two points or a few points belonging to one feature, okay?
A few points belong to one feature.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, it was like, for example, you have three red points. So let's say red is a feature, okay?
Oh, no, it's not a feature, but a class.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
So say you are doing interpolation here between, say, a few points from one class, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And on the next slide, you are doing interpolation like between different classes, like 9 or 3. And I'm confused about it.
Oh, sure. So yeah, okay. I can. You're absolutely right. So I was just showing sort of interpolation between 9s and 3s here. But we could also do interpolations between 3s. Okay. So if we did sort of interpolate on this manifold, we would hope to get other 3s that preserve the class of 3s. And ultimately, that's what we're going to be doing in the work. So we are interested in interpolating between things of the same class. This is a picture I pulled from the Bengio book, or the Bengio paper, and it's showing between different classes, okay? And so it's certainly different. But the thing is, like, what we're interested in is not losing the nature of the data. Like, I still want to get digits at the end of the day. Whether I interpolate between 3s or interpolate between 9s, I want to get some, or 9s and 3s, I want to get something that looks like a digit.
I mean, okay? what is the point of interpolating between 9 and 3? What
well, say I wasn't interested in doing classification. I was interested in building a better generative model of digits, and I just wanted a whole bunch of different digits of different variability and learn a model from that. If you're interested in doing classification, likely you're going to want to interpolate between digits of or examples of the same class, and that's what I'm going to go talk about. But I think this argument holds for both, whether you're interpolating between objects in the same class or objects in different classes, you're going to get better results interpolating if they're in some abstract feature space. That's my point. Is that okay?
Okay.
Okay. So the intuition, right, is that we want to do this interpolation or extrapolation in some latent space, not in the original input space. Okay. But we are going to do it between things in the same class. Okay, so anyways, going back to here, we might be interested in just doing these simple operations that don't depend on the nature of the data, right? Like, think back to data set augmentation, where you're sort of transforming images in color or scale, or you're rotating them and so forth. I want to do something more generic, maybe adding noise to them, or interpolating between them, or extrapolating between them. So let's do it in feature space. We could use any kind of feature extraction algorithm. We could use sort of first generation RBMs. We could use autoencoders, sparse coding, and so forth. We could use these things that are very popular right now, like generative stochastic nets or VAEs or generative adversarial networks. And this is actually a very hot area of machine learning, people proposing different types of generative models for taking data and building some latent space from it. So we could use sort of the newer stuff that's coming out. It doesn't really matter, but we have to pick something. So what we decided to try in this work is essentially something called a sequence-to-sequence autoencoder. This is popular in sequence tasks like machine translation, where, for example, you might have an English sentence in and a French sentence out. Okay, so this network observes a series of inputs. It learns a latent representation from that series of inputs, and then it's tasked to produce an output sequence. Okay, so the output sequence gets produced by starting from the last set of hidden units after observing the input sequence. It will generate a latent or a hidden state sequence, and then from that, it will map back to whatever domain, for example, words. Okay, so if this was English to French, you might have some series of hidden units that represent the semantics of what's going on in the sentence. And typically we call this thing, the last step of hidden units, we call it the context vector. And it's important because this set of hidden states, or this vector, okay, of variables, has to capture everything about this input sequence to be able to generate the translation, or whatever it is you're trying to do. Okay, so instead of taking in an input and producing something different, like in the case of translation, we're going to train an autoencoder version of this, which is essentially take an input build a representation of it, and then try to regenerate that input. Okay? So what we get from this is that we can take any input sequence and get this context vector out, which is a vector-based encoding of that sequence. Okay? So essentially, we can map sequences to vectors. And that vector captures everything going on in that sequence. And that is, we're going to actually start interpolating these guys. Okay? So those are going to be the things that we interpolate between. All right. So why would we do this? We could use any sort of representation learning algorithm. We choose this because we can work on temporal data, or we can work on static data. If we have static data like an image, we can read in the pixel stream like a sequence and still apply this sequence-to-sequence autoencoder. It's a reasonably simple approach in terms of coding it up and evaluating it. Okay? So this is the sort of block diagram of our approach, what's going on here. Right? So the first thing we do is we take all of our data, and in an unsupervised way, like say we're talking about digits again, we drop the labels, and we learn this autoencoder. Okay, that takes a sequence, okay, encodes it to some context vector, and then decodes it. Right, this is just autoencoder training on unlabeled data. Then the next step is we take any example. I'm going to show you an example of pen strokes here, just as an example. We can encode them. This part is called the encoder. We encode them to these context vectors, and then we're going to apply the data augmentation to them. So again, I'm going to assume that these are the same class. I'm going to take these guys in the same class. I'm going to map them to these context vectors. And then I'm going to interpolate between them, or extrapolate, or add noise, or do something. Then I can do one of two things. I can either use my decoder, okay, that takes context vectors and maps them back to sequences. So I can map these from the vector space back to the original sequences via the decoder. And so this would be sort of the result of interpolating these two. Or I could just apply a classifier directly to the context vectors. All right, so I just say I can map all my data to these vectors. I can augment them how I want, and then just apply the model directly to it. Okay? So just as like a visualization sanity check, when we take sequences of these sinusoids, you can have sort of a parent sinusoid, which is a dark blue, another parent, which is a dark green, and then we add noise to them in this context vector space. We've encoded them to a vector, we've added noise to the vector, and then we've decoded them and we've plotted them. So you can see it sort of retains its sinusoidal properties. When we interpolate between the two parents at various their levels of interpolation, you actually get sinusoids after you decode them, sinusoids that lie between the two parents. And same with extrapolation. You sort of push in the direction of one or the other. So this is just a visual sanity check that seems to be taking a sequence, encoding it, manipulating its context vector, and decoding that gives something reasonable. If we take a slightly more challenging data set like these pen strokes, you can see here that on the top row and the leftmost column, these are parents. So if we take any particular parent, say like up here and over here, and we interpolate them, that gives the child. Okay, after we've encoded it, interpolated it, and then decoded. And then if we do extrapolation, we can basically look at the same thing, the extrapolated version of any two particular pen strokes. Now, what we see in this is that actually there's a much more variation in the extrapolation. So that's already a clue that extrapolation might be more useful to us for data augmentation. Okay, so just sort of to give you an idea more explicitly of the synthesis procedure. Going back to that original paper or picture of having a couple different classes, the reds and the blues, if we want to add more red data, we would pick an example, we could add noise to it. Okay? Add more noise, that would generate three more data points. Okay? If we have some data, we do interpolation, what it means is I sort of select a neighbor, I interpolate between the point and its neighbor, I select another neighbor, interpolate between itself and its neighbor. I select a third neighbor, interpolate, okay? And I'm just storing this picture in original space, but this is, remember, this is working in the latent space. And then finally, what it looks like for extrapolation is we again select a point, find a neighbor, and then go in the direction of the point along the same line, basically, that connects it to its neighbor. Okay, so it looks, makes it essentially more like itself, and less like its neighbor. And then again, pick a point, extrapolate it, find another neighbor, and extrapolate beyond that. Okay, so we can generate additional data this way.
And you can go into points, in the points from the additional class. Like if you do extrapolation, then the red point can be inside the blue data set.
Exactly. So you're saying if you extrapolate too much, you could either fall into the region of the other class, or you might fall right off the data manifold entirely. So you have to limit to yourself to how much extrapolation you can do, right? So that's the tunable. There's a single hyperparameter associated with this, and that's the amount of interpolation or extrapolation you do. We found that the method wasn't super sensitive to that, but you're absolutely right. I mean, there's no guarantee that you're going to stay within the class boundary.
Lambda should run not up to infinity, but up to, I don't know, some finite number.
So what we do is we basically take the distance between any two points, and we never extrapolate beyond that distance. Okay, so we basically we have a lambda, which is some fraction of that distance between points. So that's sort of the heuristic that we use. But there might be a way of sort of, based on learning about the existing geometry of the data, sort of figuring out what's the optimal amount to extrapolate or interpolate. Future work, though. Okay, so, sorry. Okay, so just to some results on some smaller data sets that we tried this out on. The point here was to, again, create a data set agnostic version of augmentation. And so we wanted to try this on a few different domains, use the same simple technique, and see how it worked. So we did this on speech data, which comes in the format of what are called MFCCs, which is a feature representation people typically use in speech. We applied this sequence-to-sequence approach directly. We did this on hand motion capture, which is 3D data of the hands doing gesturing. And then this is actually a sign language data set on the hands. And then we also did this on full body motion capture. Again, this is action recognition from motion capture. And so what we found when we did these initial experiments is that essentially we would always get a gain from doing extrapolation in feature space. But actually using this technique with noise or doing interpolation tended to hurt the model. Okay? So in some cases we did very close to sort of the best performing methods on these data sets. In some cases, we were not super close, for example, in this setup, but we always gained over the baseline of doing no augmentation when we did augmentation with extrapolation.
So sort of it's a test. So how do you quantify the error? So there's some interpretation of like a full body.
So these are all accuracy, error in terms of like 0-1 error. So these are all classification tasks. So there's 10 classes here. You're trying, someone speaks a digit and you're trying to classify which digit that is. This one, someone does one of 95 different sign language. So you're trying to predict the right one of 95. And then this one is 16 different activities. You observe the body like doing some motion, some sort of activity. It might be like running, walking, punching, kicking, whatever. And you're classifying it. So it's classification error. Okay, so just some qualitative results. If you take punch, okay, you'll see that's the original motion capture. And you do a kick, okay? You can interpolate them in input space. Okay, now these sequences are temporally aligned already. So I can tell you that doing interpolation in input space gives you something reasonable, but if they were not temporally aligned, this would completely break down. If you map these to latent space, you do interpolation of the features, and then decode it, actually you get sort of a punch kick as well. However, you'll notice that this is a little smoother because the whole process of doing the autoencoder, sort of mapping to a latent space, and then mapping back actually does some smoothing on the data. So there's a smoothing effect that happens as well. This is sort of another blend for you. A step forward, a step left, and then you can essentially make them step forward and step left. Okay, and that's again in input space. You'll see it's a little bit jittery, and then a little bit smoother in feature space. Step forward and left, as an example. We tried this on image data. Deep learning people love to work on images. MNIST and CIFAR are sort of smaller benchmarks. Again, we found the exact same thing. Here, when we applied this to image data sets, we had to take the data as a pixel stream, okay, and we fed it to a sequence-to-sequence model, basically one row at a time. Okay, so again, same effect. When we did interpolation, it didn't really help that much, but when we did extrapolation, we certainly improved on the baseline. We then tried applying this to convolutional neural networks. Now the problem is, in this setting, I should say that for everything else so far, we've trained the encoder, we've mapped to this feature space, and then we've trained the same type of neural net directly on the features to do the classification, rather than decoding and training something on the decoder. But when you want to experiment with convolutional neural networks, convolutional neural networks are very specific to images, right? So you basically, if you're going to use a convolutional net as your classifier, you have to use the sort of encoding and decoding method of this, right? So you encode it to some feature space, you do your augmentation, you decode it back to image space, and then you train a convolutional neural net on this. And so what we found when doing this is essentially it was difficult to beat state of the art, and we think that is essentially due to a loss of fidelity when we encode it and decode it. Okay, so something's going on. So we further explored this and say, look, if we take the sort of the CIFAR data set, the images come in 32 by 32. Usually what people do is they'll try like a center crop, or they'll take center crop and augment it. So if we just work on the original images, say doing center crop, you'll get 11.2 in error. If you don't do any augmentation at all, but you just encode using an autoencoder and decode the image, you'll see there is quite a massive loss of accuracy when you do this. So, or increase in error, I should say. When you essentially use the extrapolation technique, you'll improve down from this. So, you know, given that you're already restricted to running the data through an autoencoder, this extrapolation helps. But the process of taking the data, running through an autoencoder, and back to the image space actually hurts you. So it's not super successful when using it in combination with ComNets. Okay, so anyways, in summary, what we set out to do is basically make a data set agnostic type of augmentation that could be used beyond vision, beyond speech. We proposed a way of essentially doing this with sequence-to-sequence autoencoders. And essentially, we showed it working on a number of different domains, like the speech, the handwritten pen strokes, image data, full body motion capture, and so forth. And we always use the same simple method. It actually complements standard data augmentation. So if we do it on, say, the CIFAR data set with a MLP, not a ConvNet, we can do sort of the standard rotations, scalings, and so forth. We can add this technique to it, and it does even better. And so one open question with these sort of generative models is, how can we evaluate them? Sometimes we can use something like log likelihood or some estimate of that. Sometimes we can sort of extract features using a generative model and use it for a classification task. This might be another way of evaluating unsupervised learning algorithms. Which unsupervised learning algorithm can help us on another task by synthesizing more data? Okay. So there's all kinds of different flavors of this, whether you're doing interpolation or not, or extrapolation, or maybe you're just taking a generative model, trained on some data, and you're sampling from it, okay, or using some sampling process. So I put it out there as a way of sort of proposing new generative models and evaluating them. Anyways, what we want to do with this in the future, the number one request we get is for NLP-style tasks. People don't know how to augment text data. So we're working on this in the context of sentiment analysis. It's like when somebody writes a review and you're trying to figure out whether this is a positive or a negative review. We want to do end-to-end learning. What that means is right now we have essentially a stage one, which is autoencoder, right? Then we do the manipulation. Then we have stage two, which is a classifier. We'd like to just basically have a single classifier that can basically perform augmentation in its features automatically. We've been always synthesizing between pairs of examples, neighbors, in feature space. We could probably do this with more than two examples. And finally, this came up a little bit, we'd like to learn an optimal transformation operator. Maybe interpolation or extrapolation is not the best thing to do. It probably isn't the right thing to do. Can we have a more sophisticated transformation operator working in feature space that is sort of ideal for augmentation? And, oh, I have a few other stuff, but I'm not going to go through that. I didn't know how long it would take. So with that, I want to thank Terrence, who's a student that basically worked on this, and funding. That's it. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Questions?
Yeah, so we have a couple of questions.
So what we do usually here is we use a neural network to encode a wave function, which is like this high-dimensional object, right? And so we've been using restricted Boltzmann machine so far, and mostly because we need a generative model because we wanted to draw a sample from the wave function, right? Mm-hmm. So like sometimes when I speak with machine learning people, like proper machine learning people, I feel like I'm using this like ancient tech, you know, 10 years ago. So like, if we fix, say, the amount of resources, like the number of parameters in a network, like how do Boltzmann machine compare to other generative network, like in terms of representational power, let's say?
Right. So going back to this question of how to get like a quantitative evaluation for a generative model, this is an open problem. It's really difficult. There's a great paper called On the Evaluation of Generative Models by a guy named Lucas Thies. I recommend looking at that paper because this basically the punchline of that paper is he goes through the different methods people have proposed and it says none of these are really great. It's an open question. But it's still nice to read about the different methods that people use. So say one of these things was working, then I could give you an answer of like, I could compare an RBM to an autoencoder, to a variational autoencoder, to a GAN or something and say, you know, maybe log likelihood is the right metric and I can have log likelihood on each. But log likelihood is not really the right metric. I can say there's other properties of these models that might make you choose one over the other. So for example, RBMs, we were talking about this morning, they're notoriously finicky to train, right? It doesn't matter like whether you're using contrast divergence or a different type of learning. They tend not to converge as cleanly. It's difficult to observe actually what's going on because you're not in contrast divergence is weird. You're not actually optimizing an objective, right? You're like optimizing some sort of like an approximation to an objective. So there's some properties of RBMs that makes them a little bit unfriendly. And I think that's why people have moved away from them in recent years to other things like variational autoencoders or generative adversarial networks. Okay, so I would look at it in more of their properties rather than a quantitative way because there's not a great quantitative way to assess them right now.
I'd say one of our main problems or one of our main goals would be to, I don't know if I would call it augment the data set. Imagine an autoencoder that takes an image of a certain size, encodes it down, and then makes it a bigger size, like generates a larger image.
Oh, like this is, they sometimes call this super resolution algorithms. They do this in vision, like they actually have an image and they like want to upsample it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so feedforward nets have actually been shown to do this, and also generative models have been shown to do this. So super resolution, yeah. If you look at maybe like deep learning and super resolution, you might actually you'll find actually a lot of people with papers on this type of thing that you might be able to draw from. Your data is probably a little bit weirder than the sort of usual generic images that people are probably testing this on. But I would suspect that some of that would apply to you. So you want to basically upsample the resolution of your observations. But maintain the content as if like someone had a 32 by 32 image of something and wanted to blow it up to 128 by 128.
So those super resolution methods usually require training on a high res data set, right?
Yes, yeah. So
that's the problem for us, I think. If we want to upsample something like,
imagine you don't have access to a data set over a certain size. That's our problem.
Right, because if you did it by supervised, these students would like have a bunch of 32 by 32 versions of 128 by 128 images, right? And they could just do it that way.
And then you train it that way, and then you could apply it to new 32 by 32 images, right? So
yeah.
That's how most of the super resolution stuff works right now.
Most of the working stuff is supervised. But I actually think that you could use something like a GAN, the generative adversarial network type of objective. This is the type of thing where it's an objective based on sort of fooling the network, whether it's a fake or real image. And so that's sort of, you could basically have it generating the high-res stuff, and you're still trying to figure out whether the high-res stuff matched real data versus synthetic data. I can't think of a paper off the top of my head that does like GAN-based super resolution, but I would suspect somebody has attempted it.
Yeah, I have another question. So when you were, you showed at the beginning that you were doing a search in the architecture of the network.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like when you propose a new architecture,
mm-hmm.
So are you taking into account all the previous accuracy, or is it just like a naive search, just?
Yeah, so I do have a, let me just see if I have a picture for you. How old is this? Yeah. I think the picture is in here. Give me a second, the slides are a bit old. Yeah, I do have it. Okay, so, we're using this. This is out of a paper by Eric Brashu, but I like this is the picture that explains it the best. Okay, so you observe a particular architecture. Okay, so you pick one randomly, and you measure its performance on some data set, and it tells you the performance is here. Okay, so you get 1 point, and then you try another totally random architecture, and you measure its performance, and it does a little bit better up here. Okay, and so what the Bayesian optimization method does is it builds a model sort of, I'm only showing it in one dimension, but there's obviously different choices like that impact your architecture. But basically, say this is like the architecture axis, and this is its performance. So you have certainty about how this architecture performed and how this architecture performed, and then you have uncertainty that's sort of between these ones. So as you get further and further from the known architectures, this purple shows the sort of uncertainty that you have about the architectures that would lie here. Again, assuming that they all lie along like a 1D axis. Now, what Bayesian optimization does, it not only has this function, it has another function called the acquisition function. And the acquisition function tells you which architecture to try next. And it tries to balance between what worked well before, like this guy works well, and explore areas of uncertainty. So you've heard this in reinforcement learning, exploration versus exploitation. It's exactly what this thing is doing. So it says actually try this architecture next because it's close to the one that worked well, but it's also going to reduce your uncertainty in this area. So then you try it, you found that it didn't work as well, but now you've reduced your uncertainty. And then this acquisition function says, okay, try over here, we haven't explored here. And so you basically do this. So you reduce your uncertainty in your model, and then you basically, you decide how many architectures you're going to try out, 20, 100, before you run out of computational resources, and you basically take the one that worked the best. Yep.
And if you decide you take 100 tries and you would also run a test where you use 100 times the computational resources, but you use your initial network, just make it bigger, like give it more parameters, so
oh, sure.
To gain in that way, would you beat?
I suspect that this would work better than just throwing more parameters at the network. Based on the previous work where I said there was a student that was sort of hand tuning it and figuring out what the right fusion architecture is, she also explored things like what's the right amount of parameters to put in that network. And at the end of the day, if you put too many parameters in, you're going to start overfitting the data. So I think starting on this work where we were doing automatic architecture search, we already kind of had a feeling for what was the sort of appropriate number of parameters or what the appropriate model complexity was. So yeah, we didn't try the experiment, but my hunch is that this still would buy you something.
It depends how big your data set is, obviously. Yeah.
Absolutely, and this CHA-learn like gesture recognition data set is not the same scale as like ImageNet. I mean, it's just harder to collect, right? Because you got to bring people in and film them like gesturing and record it. It's not like something you can just grab off Google.
Do you know if the Inception network, for example, if they did
yep.
something like that to find it, or is it more like we make a guess.
Right. So Inception and ResNet and those things have been built essentially by hand, like people having good ideas and looking at previous architectures. And then also for sort of internal parameters, like how deep is it? They obviously do some sort of systematic search. There is some more recent work by Google that actually uses reinforcement learning for architecture search. People complain about it because they use so much power to do those experiments that I forget what order it's definitely like on the order of like tens of millions of dollars in like wasted power, because these things are like really, really expensive to do the search. So anyways, like the classic architectures that we see, like the Inceptions and ResNets, those are still trained, like designed by hand.
So DataFirm would take a network like, I don't know, 10 times smaller, and instead try 100 different ones, one would probably do less good.
Yeah, that's the type of thing that they do, yeah. We haven't seen sort of model-generated architectures like hit the mainstream. Yeah, it's kind of an active area of research.
So why would the reinforcement learning network architectures be better than Bayesian optimization?
I don't know if I would have a reason to say one is necessarily preferred to the other. I mean, in Bayesian optimization, we need to come up with this kernel that can compare one architecture versus another architecture. The kernel that we came up with is fairly general, but we really only tested it on this reduced search space, right, where we add fully connected layers and change the order of the mergers. I think the RL method might be a little bit more general, so that may be one reason to prefer it. You don't have to come up with this kernel. It took a lot of time and a lot of power. Yeah, the back.
So having the sequence structure in the autoencoder, does it improve a lot things, or compared to having the standard one?
And just doing this work on a static autoencoder.
Yeah.
We didn't do that because we were measuring it on sequence data sets anyways. So I can tell you that if we had just used a static autoencoder and say mapped our sequences to vectors, that never really works very well. Now, for just the images, we tried a convolutional autoencoder that was only on the image data sets. And that worked. I mean, I wouldn't say any better or worse than the sequence to sequence. It's just with sequence to sequence, we could use one architecture for static or temporal data. So that's why we preferred it.
Yeah, the following question. So in our research, we are trying to study neural network, and we are trying to study cells. The vector, okay, so you were talking about, okay, say in the middle layer, okay, which encodes, say the image, for example, or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we are trying to study how actually the vector encodes, say the input, okay? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so my question is, do you know about any research that has been done about this? Maybe more general questions, for example, how do neural network actually learn things? I mean, how do they encode?
This is the best demonstrations I've ever seen for how the neural network actually manipulates the input space to form representations is on a guy named Chris Ola's blog. Have you ever seen Chris Ola's blog?
Maybe not.
You should look at it. He has some really, really nice visualizations. I always like showing them to students or people who I'm talking to about static models or temporal models. I don't know if I'm on. I don't think I have Edgy Rome here. I can't show you. Chris Ola, and his blog's called C Ola's Blog. He has some excellent visual demonstrations and insights in terms of what's actually, how you formulate those feature spaces and what's going on, and why sort of adding layers is a sensible thing. And he'll obviously point you towards the relevant papers as well. I think it's a good starting point.
All right, lunch time.
much.
Yeah.
Same for you again.